Welcome to the Fanboy Factor Podcast. I am your friendly neighborhood J-Man. With me is our resident comic book historian, Brian Isaacs. Brian, how's it going?
Doing great, man. How are you this week?
Not too bad. Brian, we have a special guest again today. We have the writer-producer of Arrow, currently writing X-Men, and the author of the novel Overwatch, Mark Guggenheim. How's it going, Mark?
It's going really well. Thanks for having me on the show.
Thanks for coming on.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
No, my pleasure. My pleasure. I love fanboys and I love podcasts, so what's not to like?
So we are entering season 3 of Arrow, and season 2 just, you know, I loved it, blew me out of the water, and I cannot wait to see what you have in store for season 3. It's the little nuggets that are coming out of the news so far. I cannot wait.
Spoil away, Mark.
Yeah, if you can.
You'll probably get me to spoil something on this podcast, I'm sure. We'll do it organically, though.
No pressure, of course.
We're working away on it right now. We're filming episode 7, writing episode 10, and breaking episode 11. So this is the week where, you know, I sort of feel like we've reached the halfway mark, where it's, we're halfway through the season, basically. So, you know, for us, it's, of course, you know, it's the writing. It's, you know, we're not halfway through the season filming-wise, but writing-wise, getting dangerously close to it.
Wow. So you have seven, you said you had 7 episodes done, right?
We are filming 7 as we speak.
So is it for you, you have a bunch of stuff that's done. Do you get excited, like, we haven't even started the season yet, and are you like, okay, something happened in episode 5, and I can't wait for it to hit? Do you get like that?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, yeah. There's so much about the show that we're dying to show people. At the same time, it's a little terrifying to do the show. I always call this, like, this is like in Apollo 13 when they're on the dark side of the moon. the ship is out of range of communication, is sort of how I think of this period of production, where we're basically – We're doing stuff that we hope people will like, we hope people will respond to, but we have no idea what ultimately is going to resonate with. So it's a very scary and interesting time, and it's unbelievable to me that we're getting so dangerously close to our season premiere.
Now, I one of the things to come out of the news is that you're going to be having Ted Grant, a.k.a. Wildcat, on the show. Yep. And I just heard from somebody else this week that in the comic version, Arrow 2.5, I think it is.
Yeah, 2.5.
Yeah, that you just had the boxing glove Arrow. Any chance we might see it on the show?
I'm not quite ready to spoil anything yet.
So close, Brian!
I know. But suffice it to say, I think people will be very happy. Fans of the Boxing Glove Arrow will be very, very, very happy this year.
Do you get a lot of requests for that?
You know, yeah. Basically, ever since the show premiered, we've had people ask us, when are you doing the Boxing Glove Arrow? When are you doing the Boxing Glove Arrow? And it's a source of amusement to us that it's so important to so many people. But I'm glad. I'm glad that they're, you know, interested in such things. But we've always said that we would, you know, do it if we could do it in a way that fit tonally with the show.
Yeah.
You know, so that's really always our barometer, is that we want to make sure that we're being true to the tone that we've established for the show. And with that caveat in mind, everything's fair game. You know, we always want to do things, you know, that push the envelope on the show, that amuse the fans, that, you know, aren't just, you know, fan service, but legitimately cool in their own right, and belong in the show in their own right, as opposed to just doing something just because people have asked for it. You know, we've been, I think, pretty good about sort of ticking off all those boxes, but the fans have also been pretty good about being patient and waiting for us to find the exact right time and the exact right way to do things.
Cool. Very cool. I mean,
have you put anything in the show that people have missed or have maybe missed initially and you were surprised by that?
Yeah, actually, in episode 11 of the first season, we basically said, like a screaming neon sign, that Oliver did not spend all of his time on Leanne Yu. I mean, he basically tells Diggle that. And, like, and we went on Twitter and waiting to see what people would say in response to that, and not a single peep, not a single person said And we were a little surprised. It was like, wow, this is weird. And then, of course, you know, when we had in season two, Oliver goes on the freighter, you know, the Amazo. That, I think, is when a lot of people said, oh, that's what he meant. That's what Oliver meant when he said that he hasn't always been on Leanne Yu. And then, of course, we ended season two. If you haven't watched season two, spoiler alert. Then we ended season two with the reveal that he ended up in Hong Kong. But we were really surprised when back in episode 111, no one really flagged it.
Sure.
For the most part, I think people are really, really, you know, our viewers are very astute. Nearly everything, pretty much everything, gets noticed. you know, the most obscure Easter eggs that we can find, someone on Twitter will pick up on.
Yeah, I tweeted you after, like, during the final, and because I picked up on Easy Company, and you told me, yeah. I was one of the few people who actually got that reference.
I think you were actually the only one who got it. that was funny. That was one of those instances where we came dangerously close to doing an Easter egg that no one noticed, but you kept the streak alive, which I appreciate very much.
Good job, Brian.
Yeah, good job. Well done.
Yeah, that just means that we read too many comic books.
No, it's great. I mean, it's you know, if you do, so do I. It's nice to have some company. We, you know, and it's funny, I wrote that particular Easter egg into the finale, and I was, like, I was so amused with myself when I did it. I was like, oh, this is fun. You know, sometimes it's funny. I think the visual Easter eggs are the ones that resonate with people the most, which is depressing to me because I think, you know, it suggests that people are watching the show more than they are listening to it.
Right.
And Easy Company was obviously an auditory Easter egg. But, you know, like I said, with all the, you know, tens of thousands of people following the show on Twitter, at least, you know, there's only someone, you know, thank you. Thank God for you, Brian, who catches all the crazy Easter eggs that we put into the show.
And you have Roy finally stepping into the Arsenal role.
Yeah.
The original Titans, the original Fab Five, I grew up with them, so it's just like, you know, Roy, Dick, Garth, and Wally, and Donna are just, they're my favorite characters, so just to see him finally step up, I can't wait to see it. The costume looks excellent.
We talk about the Titans all the time, and our love for the Titans is far and wide.
Yeah.
Oh, mine too. I mean, I'm a huge, huge Titans fan. I'm obviously a big fan of the new Teen Titans, the Wolfman Perez era, and it's amazing, actually, how much of that mythology we've managed to get into the show, you know, of course, including Deathstroke. I'm, like, amazed that we got away with that. But, you know, that's been a real boon to the show, obviously. And having Roy don the Arsenal costume is really exciting. In fact, the season 2.5 comic that bridges seasons 2 and 3 will explain how he ended up going from just wearing a mask in the finale to a full-fledged costume. There's actually a story behind it and an explanation. And then, of course, you know, the costume will premiere with the season premiere with 301, and, of course, people will start asking, well, when are you going to start calling him Arsenal? When are you going to start calling him Arsenal? And people will have to watch the show.
I really got to ask, how does it feel to kind of be like a trendsetter, because it's just like, now with the announcement this week of Supergirl going to CBS, with an exception of ABC, just about every network has a DC property TV show now.
Yeah.
And you're pretty much the trendsetter here, Mark. How does it feel?
You know, I mean, I think, you know, Andrew, Greg, and I, we all are kind of blown away by what has happened. You know, someone after, I think, it's funny, I can't even keep track of all the announcements, but someone tweeted at me, And to think this all began with Arrow, and it's like, it actually stopped me short. I was like, oh, wait a minute, it kind of sort of did, this era anyway. You know, and it's amazing. I mean, and we're very humbled by it, and we're kind of, it puts a lot of good pressure on the show because, you know, I don't think Greg, Andrew, or I are, we're not satisfied with being, you know, the first. We really want to be the best. And really, you know, even though Greg's doing Flash and Supergirl, and even though, you know, Andrew and Greg are doing Flash, there's, I think, a big, you know, pressure that we put on the ourselves to make Arrow, you know, be as good as it possibly can be each day of the week. We're not resting on our laurels, and we're not saying, oh, well, we've, you know, we're in season three and we can start taking it easy. There's a just a huge amount of passion behind the show, and I think it's honestly the thing that makes the show special, is that we are never, you know, we never phone it in. We never say, well, we're doing 23 episodes a year and not all 23 can be good. No, we're actually determined to make all 23 as good as we possibly can make them.
What kind of leeway do you have on writing the show? Do you like, when you write the script, how much involvement does DC have? Do they just say, hey, we trust you, write what you want to write?
I do think that they do trust us. I don't think they say write what you want to write, but they are very supportive and they are incredibly, you know, vocal about championing the show, and they're very trusting of our instincts. You know, DC is basically, they're part of the normal notes giving process. They give notes on every story document. They give notes on every script. They watch all the cuts periodically throughout the year. We'll bring them into the writer's room and just sort of pitch them the next sort of chunk or the next piece of the arc. So they know everything that we're doing and they weigh in. And, you know, it's a really great group over there, and it's a very supportive environment. You know, they also help us navigate which character can we use, which characters can't we use. If we can't use this character, can we use that character? And they're very helpful with suggesting. You know, it's not just, their job is not just to say no. They're also incredibly helpful in telling us, well, no, but, you know, or no, but yes to this. And they're just great partners. We've been very fortunate to, you know, to have them. And I think the show is a success, in large part because of the environment that they've created that allows us to do the show that we're doing.
It's just been pretty amazing because previous shows have always had what's kind of been known as the so-called Bat Mandate, where like Smallville and even like the cartoon Justice League really couldn't use elements from a lot of the Batman universe. But here you are introducing Ra's al Ghul and Nyssa and some other. It's just like, okay, this is cool. Can't wait.
Yeah. Well, and by the way, that was all thanks to DC. I mean, it was. Very sort of early on, like, you know what, you can mention the League of Assassins, and you know what, you can name drop Roz, and oh, wait, you can have Nyssa, and it just, you know, they've got a whole intellectual property universe to manage, so, and I don't envy them that job. You know, also, I think, like, you know, the thing that is advantageous for us is, in the comics, Malcolm Merlyn is a member of the League of Assassins, and that's really where the Ra's al Ghul of it all on Arrow began. We basically wrote a backstory for him into the show that was very consistent with his backstory from the comics, where he, you know, was trained by the League of Assassins. And once, you know, I think that sort of, that was our Trojan horse getting in. And then we just, you know, kept going. And DC was incredibly supportive and very, you know, positive about it. And, you know, it's been a lot of fun. I mean, we love playing with the sandbox. I mean, that's one of the real pluses of working on the show for us, is to have access to this rich treasure trove of characters.
When you write a season, do you have a story arc for the whole season, or do you go in by episode, okay, this is what we're going to do here? Like, how much of that is flexible in your mind?
Well, we do start off with a arc for the entire season.
Okay, so the whole season has an arc.
The whole season has an arc, and it has a beginning, middle, and end, and it has a character arc, you know, for Oliver. We know what his, you know, sort of emotional or character trajectory of the year is going to be. We know how he's going to start the year. We know how he's going to end the year. We know how.
What about the other characters? Do they have that kind of arc too?
Yes, okay. For the most part, yes. Like, you know, I'll give you an example, like Laurel's problem with drugs and alcohol last year and the sort of her decline and then ultimate, you know, sort of climbing back up out of the, you know, out of the depths of despair, that was all planned ahead.
Okay.
You know, so, yeah, all the characters have their own arcs and they're all planned out. And as far as flexibility is concerned, I always sort of, I like to think of it as the way I like to travel to Europe. I like to have an itinerary. I like to have my restaurant reservations made, and I like to have my tour guides booked, and you know, I like to have my, you know, my museum time planned out. But at the same time, when I go there, if I hear about this amazing cafe, I'm not beholden to my itinerary. I'm going to go check out the amazing cafe. So that's sort of the way we approach a whole season of Arrow. We have a very, you know, clear trajectory and a clear plan for the show and all the characters, but at the same time, we give ourselves the permission to be inspired and come up with new ideas and put new twists on things. And I'd say each, you know, season one and season two were, you know, very good, I think, examples of what I'm talking about, where a lot of things that happened were planned from the very, very beginning. At the same time, there were some surprises. I mean, surprises even to us. So when you're doing 23 episodes and you have a season-long arc like that, there's enough room for things that happen with great specificity that are planned out way in advance. And at the same time, there's room for inspiration to strike. And I think that's, you know, that's the best of both worlds. But I took sort of great pride being on the set of the finale and sort of realizing, wow, you know, all these moments that we're filming right now, we pitched those like almost a year earlier to the studio and the network.
It's got to be fulfilling.
It is. It's really fulfilling. It's very, it's a little bit of a head trip. You know, it's a wonderful thing to be able to go, hey, you know what? We had a plan and we executed on that plan. And at the same time, it's, you know, really great to allow yourself to be surprised. And I think we always say we need a plan, even if we're going to deviate from it. I think that's because the plan gives us the comfort and gives us the confidence to start deviating. And that's really what allows us to get this mix of, you know, a little bit of inspiration, a little bit of planning all combined to make for a great season.
You got a lot of things going on so far this season, and really hasn't been announced. I mean, Ray Palmer on the show. And
How did he get picked?
Straight up, we were originally going to do Ted Kord.
Oh, Brian!
And DC had some other plans for him. And they were the ones, again, this is a, you know, a great example of what I was talking about. They were the ones who said, well, no to Ted Kord, but yes to, what about Ray Palmer? And we're like, yes, please. That sounds good to us. it's awesome. And Brandon Routh is just a dream bit of casting for us. He's fantastic on the show. I mean, he's so magnetic and he's a different color. One of the things that we wanted to do with season three was introduce a new change agent to the show. Someone who would just sort of come in and shake things up and, you know, be a different kind of character than what we've seen on the show to date. He's so similar to Oliver in the sense that he's, you know, also a leading man hero type, but at the same time, he's so completely different from Oliver because he's funny, and he talks a lot and he talks fast and he, you know, he's such a different color, than our usual taciturn guys that we've had on the show. He's more in the vein of Felicity in terms of how we write him.
Is he going to be in costume?
I'd wait.
Close.
You know, it's funny. On that one, earlier this week, Brandon spoiled that he'd be wearing a costume. So I suppose it's sort of out there. At some point, there is a costume in Ray Palmer's future.
That was a very long pause.
It's kind of different to see, like, Palmer in an industrial role, because I'm so used to seeing him in the comics as just a scientist. So I really can't wait to see how you guys are going to portray him. It really looks good so far.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm really excited. It's you know, we're being very true to his, to his comic book roots, but at the same time doing what we, oftentimes do, which is take some liberties. So he's still a scientist, and he's still, as he says in episode two, the smartest person in any given room. But at the same time, he's, instead of being in academia, he's in corporate finance. And at the same time, it feels like the right kind of place for him. Brandon and his character really fit into our world very, very nicely. And there's a great little, I don't know if you can call it an Easter egg, but an homage to Ray Palmer's Adam costume in the season premiere, specifically the belt buckle and how he would activate his his size-changing ability. So that's something that you might want to, Brian, you'll be the only person who gets it. you should keep your eyes open for that.
I always do. Please, I'm like, when I watch her, I'm like there with like trying to, I'm with there with a notebook trying to catch everything.
He's always putting comments on Facebook to let everybody know.
I think we're going to try to be a little bit better about inventorying our, our, what's it called? Easter egg inventory, if you will. You know what I mean?
Yes.
Yeah. So it's hopefully we'll make your life a little bit easier.
I don't mind it. Trust me,
it's part of the fun. I mean, I do think it's part of the fun of the show. And I always, especially in season three, I'm like, how do we make these Easter eggs, more clever? Like in season three, one of my new favorite Easter egg is Captain Carrot Soup. Captain Carrot Stew, where the packaging features Captain Carrot from the comics.
That's a good one.
Yeah, that's my favorite. It's my latest favorite. It's a real fun part of the show. We get a chance to, tip our hat to all these, not just these characters that inspire us, but also we'll name check various writers and artists that, it started out just as, writers and artists who are associated with the, with the comic Green Arrow, but it's since expanded to pretty much, anyone and everyone who's worked for DC. Because you can run out of names pretty fast.
Yeah. So how woven is Green Arrow going to be, Arrow, how woven is Arrow going to be with Flash this season?
I'd say, pretty closely, there's going to be a crossover event that we're working on right now in November that is, Arrow's going to go over to Flash, and then Flash is going to go over to Arrow. And it's going to feel very, very, very interconnected. Stuff that happens on one show is reflected in the other. They're taking place in the same universe. Some of it may be sort of, Easter egg territory, and others are, like if Central City blows up, you can be sure we're going to mention that on Arrow and vice versa.
Yeah.
Knowing Starling City, it's probably more likely that Starling City will blow up. we're definitely in season three. We're definitely, hanging a lantern on the fact that as one character says in the season premiere, Starling City has been the victim of two terrorist attacks in as many years. And they always seem to happen in May for some reason.
It's weird.
So strange.
Strange.
So was that lantern comment a drop of anything, or?
Oh, hang a lantern? No, hang a lantern.
Because there's a lot of theories going on about out there about Diggle might actually be Stewart. People really want to see Hal because of the brotherhood between them. I'm not going to say anymore because you probably hear enough of it.
It's one of those things where that's the type of thing that DC. It's up to DC. They're really in charge of the property in that regard. I'm waiting for news the same way everyone else is.
Cool. And Jesse and I did get a chance to see the pilot for Flash, and you know, it was very well done. It was, very much so. And the conversation between the two characters was, I really thought that was well written, and just, you know, Ollie inspiring Barry to be a hero was just a really great job. But it's, the way he did it was like, pretty much said he was a, you know, Ollie was a character who hides in the dark, while, you know, Barry should be someone who comes into the light, which was really a nice, you know, difference between the two characters.
That's something we're trying to bring out in the crossover. The idea that they're two very different shows. You know, it's we always say it's Superman and Batman. It's Metropolis and Gotham.
Right.
And that's fun. I mean, the acknowledgement of the differences between the two shows, to me, was one of the more fun aspects of writing the crossover. Because it's a fun bit of meta, you know, to have the characters recognize that they're on tonally different shows.
Speaking of Superman and Batman, what are your, do you have any thoughts on Ollie being in Batman vs. Superman? Because, you know, it's, people get into these arguments on the internet all the time about whether, I think most people would really like to see Arrow in that movie. You have any thoughts?
Oh, I have many thoughts. They're all above my pay grade. I'm not trying to duck the question.
It's understandable.
It's just above my pay grade. I don't get to make these decisions, and it's not, and as a result, it's really not appropriate for me to weigh in.
Understood.
I knew we'd find something I couldn't talk about.
leave it to me to ask.
Mark, I'm also in the process of reading your book, Overwatch.
Thank you. Thanks for reading.
God, I'm really enjoying it a lot.
Thank you.
Now, this is your first novel?
This is my first novel, it was fun to do. I mean, it was a really, really interesting experience. I've been writing television for 14 years and, you know, movies for, you know, going on, I guess, 7 years, and you're basically writing, you know, teleplays and screenplays as one person, as one cog in a very large machine. When you write a novel, you're the art director, you're the actor, you're the director, you're the cinematographer. You're doing everyone else's job, or all the jobs that I'm used to having other people do. So it's a very eye-opening and interesting experience. I had a blast writing it, and I've been very fortunate. The feedback that I've gotten about the novel has been really positive, and that's very nice, particularly for a first book, where I really truly had no idea what the hell I was doing.
And a lot of it's about a CIA lawyer. Did you have to do did you have people that you spoke to get all this research from? And I mean, how do you get all this information?
It's a combination of a variety of things. I used to be an attorney, so I felt like I had a good chunk of the law stuff covered. I toured the CIA. They were very magnanimous and let me tour around. The internet is actually a remarkable source of information, but that was all to write the first draft of the manuscript. And then I had the luckiest thing in the world happen to the project. My brother's brother-in-law basically came out of the closet as being a former CIA agent.
Wow.
That's coincidental.
And it was remarkable. It was like I literally just finished it, and my brother David, you know, called me up. He's like, let me tell you something interesting. and interesting enough, he was looking to do some consulting work on Hollywood projects. And I'm like, well, have I got a project for him? So he was incredibly, I'm trying to avoid using his name because he asked me not to, he was remarkably helpful in giving the book that verisimilitude that I was going for. And I really wanted the book to be sort of chock full of all these little interesting factoids about the way the CIA operates, or the way the CIA looks, the fact that there's a Starbucks there, you know, things of that nature. I wanted to immerse the reader in this world, this fun world of espionage meets law.
Yeah, I'm reading it now. I'm probably like a third of the way through it so far, but I'm really enjoying it. It's very well done. I like these type of thrillers anyhow, so it's.
Thank you.
You did a really great job on it, Mark.
I really appreciate it. Thank you so much. I love legal thrillers and I love techno thrillers, and I always sort of describe Overwatch as my version of a Reese's peanut butter cup. You know, hopefully I took two great tastes that taste great together.
How long did it take you to write it?
That's a great question. It was written over the course off and on over several years. I would say if I put all the time together, it probably took like a year, year and a half to do the first draft. But that year, year and a half was really spread out over the course of a lot of time and a lot of years. And also, of course, you know, there was the whole conquering the learning curve of writing for a brand new medium. That took a little doing. I learned so much in the process of doing it. I just want to write another novel, really, to apply all the stuff I felt like I learned from doing this one.
And you're also currently writing a Ark of the X-Men, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes and no. I just hit send on the email containing the last chapter to my editors this morning, in fact. So, obviously, you know, I'll do their notes and I'll do a pass and I'll do lettering notes and things of that nature. But the first draft of the last chapter was finished, this morning. So, and it was a total blast. I mean, writing that arc from start to finish was just so much fun. You know, I'm a huge X-Men fan from way, way, way back when. And every time I get a chance to swim in those waters, it's a real privilege because, I just love those characters, and some of them, you know, like Storm, I've been literally reading for decades. So their voices are so clear in my head. And so, you know, they resonate so strongly with me. That's always a dream gig whenever I get to write the X-Men.
Okay. So you write scripts, you write a novel and you're writing comics. Do you find it hard to switch gears for any of this stuff? Like, do you wake up in the morning, okay, I'm going to script out comic, and then I still have to finish this part of Arrow? Do you have any problems switching gears mentally?
I used to. I used to have an enormous trouble switching gears. And then over the years, I just sort of got better at it. Switching gears is really it's a muscle or a skill that you can learn and train yourself to do.
Yeah.
When I first started out in the business, my second year in the business, I was working on Law and Order, and I had the previous year sold a romantic comedy spec that I had written. And when you sell a spec, it almost always includes a rewrite, a contractual rewrite. And I would try to divide my day up just a day. Like the first half of the day, I'd write Law and Order, and then after lunch, I would write the rewrite on the romantic comedy, and I couldn't pull that off. I couldn't go from a murder mystery homicide investigation to a light frothy romantic comedy, even if I separated them with a meal. But now I can do that. I can do that in a heartbeat without even thinking about it. And it really has everything in the world to do with just, practice. You know, and that's sort of the other thing. It's like, I always have like a plan, like I know when I'm going to get my writing done and, you know, how I'm going to organize my day. But like, you know, I was sort of describing with Arrow, I always want to give myself permission to let inspiration strike. And a lot of times, like I'll be driving to work with one plan, but my mind will wander. And by the time I get into the office, I've got this whole other idea on a completely different project than I planned that I have to get down on paper. So, and that to me is, you know, one of the joys of writing is the opportunity to have inspiration strike and never knowing when it's going to strike and never knowing how it's going to strike and being able to run with it. That to me is a huge, huge, huge reason why I write as a writer.
How long did you run Law & Order?
3 years.
Which one?
The original flavor.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, it was fun. I was on the show for years 12, 13, and 14. And it was great fun. It was, I learned a ton about writing and producing. You know, obviously very proud to be involved with the show. I met my wife on the show. I really enjoyed it. I basically finished my contract. I was negotiating to come back when I got the offer to go on to a show called Jack and Bobby. And, you know, after 3 years on any show, you sort of feel like you're sort of writing the show in your sleep a little bit. And I don't think it's a wonderful thing for any writer to spend, you know, too much time on one particular show, lest it become too easy to write.
If you don't mind, if we switch gears back to Arrow for a sec. I got to ask, because I always bring this up to you. Have you had any more luck about, because you and I, we both seem to be fans of Vic Sage. Any more luck trying to get him on the show?
Oh, you know, not at the moment, because I think we sort of hit, I wouldn't say critical mass, but with Ted Grant and Ray Palmer and Katana and all the various characters that we have coming on to Arrow this year,
right.
You don't want to just keep throwing
characters.
But, you know, obviously, as you know from our previous conversations, Vic is, you know, very, very, very high on my list.
Yeah, me too.
onto Arrow. And it's funny, in many ways, it's just like the boxing glove Arrow in the sense that, you know, we're just waiting for the opportunity. And the nice thing I have to say about where Arrow is right now in terms of its ratings and in terms of its popularity is we're starting to sort of change gears mentally from thinking about the show as, you know, going from season to season and rather starting to think of it in terms of, okay, well, this could go for, you know, for several years. And that allows us to think, you know, more long term. You know, like, for example, and I'm getting far afield of the original question, but like one of the things that that we've started doing is like we know what Oliver's arc for season four is going to be now, and we knew that at the beginning of this year. And that's the fun, you know, thing about being involved with a show that you know will have some longevity to it, because you really can start planning, you know, and we love to, as you know, as I said, we love to plan. You can really start planning out very far in advance.
Definitely can't wait for the season to start, I'll tell you that.
I know. We are, we're not as much as we are. This feels like a longer wait to me than last year did. Than the wait for season two, which of course is completely irrational because they're the exact same amount of time. But, I really can't wait for people to see season three.
Man, I follow Stephen Amell on Facebook, and it seems like he's having a blast on the set a lot of times. It's some of the stuff he posts through, you know, Instagram and Twitter. It looks like he's having a lot of fun.
Seems like he really loves that job.
He does. Oh my God. He eats, sleeps, and breathes the show. And we're very lucky. We have a remarkable cast, who all just are so passionate about the show and they all like each other. They're all enjoying, you know, toward the end of last year, I forget which actor said this to me, but basically they were like, yeah, we always got along, but by the end of last year, they all became friends. Like and really enjoy hanging out with each other, and you know they've got, you know, a million and one jokes and a million and one little gags that they play on each other, and it's really nice. It's so great to see. We have, this is the best crew I've ever worked with, and the cast is just so phenomenal and works so well with the crew, and it's a great thing. We're very, very, very lucky.
All right. Brian, you got any more questions?
I think I could try and probe him for more spoilers, but I'm
just going to ask more spoilery stuff.
Yeah, I don't see that happening. He's too good for us.
I'm sorry. I'm trying to think of like something to spoil, but it's so.
Captain Carrot. I'm looking for. I'm going to be looking for that one.
Yeah, I can't wait to see that.
Captain Carrot. I'm just going to keep writing him in. Good other good Easter eggs coming up. Unfortunately, you know, everything starts to blend together in my head, but I have to say I'm having a real blast doing the season 2.5 comic. I thought, you know, when I took this on, I thought, geez, like, I'm not writing enough Arrow right now. but it's great fun. And I mentioned it mainly because if you're fans of the show, and you're fans of Easter eggs, the comic book is great because, like the boxing glove Arrow, I can do some things that we couldn't necessarily get away with on the show. But also I get a chance to lay in the foundation for things that are coming in season three. So you really feel like the whole universe, is very tied in with, you know, tied in together, and it's tightly integrated. And that just sort of, that appeals to the geek in me.
Now that you start to introduce, like, superpowers into this Arrow universe, I mean, are we going to start seeing, things from space, or, I mean, do you see possibly doing, you know, something along the lines of Superman, or, you know, where it's, like, alien type of things, or, like, Aquaman, where it's mutations? I mean, do you eventually see yourself going somewhere down that path? Or are you hoping to?
You mean on Arrow?
Yeah.
You know, no, not really. We've learned on Arrow never to say never. The thing about the Flash spinoff is, it actually, I think it's going to mean a more grounded season for Arrow. Like, we brought in the Mirakuru into the Arrow world, and I feel like that's, you know, that's probably the most sort of sci-fi Arrow's likely to get, because if you want more sci-fi, then, like, you can go to Flash. Like, Flash exists now as a better repository for those kinds of characters and those kinds of stories than Arrow is. So I think Flash's existence, the show's existence, means a more grounded Arrow. Because it's not, you know, Arrow's not the only game in town to tell these kinds of stories. So if there was a desire to do a show, do an episode about a character coming from outer space or an alien invasion or whatever, Flash is the more likely, venue for that kind of story than Arrow is. That being said, like, you know, with Arrow, we're always, like I said, we've learned never to say never. For us, it's always a tonal question. You know, would we do an alien invasion story? My answer is probably not, but if we were to do it, it would all depend upon how we do it in a way that is consistent tonally with the show. Like, and again, I sort of use the Mirakuru serum as a good example. That was obviously much more sci-fi than something we would have contemplated in season one. Mm-hmm. But in season two, we did it, you know, we did it the Arrow way. We did it, you know, there was, you know, dialogue sort of designed to ground it in quote unquote real world things like gene therapy and whatnot. You know, we always want to try to ground the most fantastical thing in the most realistic way possible whenever we do it on Arrow, just because that's the tone of the show. And right. While the tone, you know, of Arrow, we've proven can get, you know, slightly larger, or we can broaden the definition of what that tone is. We always want to be very, very cognizant of the bullseye we're trying to hit, even if the bullseye gets bigger.
No pun intended.
Indeed.
But that world's out science fiction, but what about things like magic and stuff? Would that still be,
I think it's the same sort of litmus test, which is, you know, can we do magic in a way that is consistent with the tone of the show?
Okay.
You know, that's really our thing. It's like, if we can do it in the, you know, in consistent with the tone of the show, then that is where we start saying, okay, well, what are the ideas? You know, and that's really the other thing, is we always approach these stories from a character perspective first. We first talk in terms of, what do we want the characters to experience? What do we want the characters to go through this season, this week, this episode? And if in that process, the best thing is, oh, you know what? They're visited by a magician from outer space. Then you would find the right way tonally to make that work within the context of the show. But it always starts with the characters first.
Makes sense. Pretty good to say. It's, you know, just wondering how big the world is going to get. And it's just like, you know, now that Flash has been added to it, just seems like the entire world is just starting to get a little bigger. But it's nice to see you're just kind of like staying, I guess, for lack of a better term, street level.
Yeah, I think, I always use, you know, the Marvel Cinematic Universe as an analogy, or as proof of concept, because, you know, one of the things I think Marvel's done really, really well is a Captain America movie feels like a Captain America movie. A Thor movie feels like a Thor movie, even after Avengers.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we always want Arrow to feel like Arrow. We do want it to feel street level, and we do want it to feel like the show that you've been watching for 2 years. The challenge for us, and I don't mean challenge in a bad way, it's actually something that really excites us creatively. The challenge is, how do we, you know, remain consistent with our roots in this wider universe that has been established? It's a fun challenge. It's a fun writing challenge for us. And it forces us to constantly question, again, in a good way, or re-examine, I should say. It forces us to re-examine what the tone of the show is, or what, you know, we consider the core of the show. That's really what brings, you know, us always back to character, 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 character.
It's just amazing how you've taken this, you know, Green Arrow really has never had, per se, a rogues gallery, but you have really built one up.
By necessity. Like, it's funny, I go into the Flash writer's room, and they've got cards all over the place. Character, that character, like, rogues gallery, we've got 20 different rogues to use. Whereas Arrow's got Count Vertigo, which we're doing twice, and Merlin. Like, that's it. That's the ball game for us. So we definitely had to create an add to that rogues gallery. We're bringing Komodo in from the recent Jeff Lemire run. But yeah, he's got a pretty anemic rogues gallery. It's been a challenge, and it's definitely made me very jealous for Flash.
That run with Komodo was a great run.
Yeah, no, it was outstanding. And, you know, certainly Komodo as a character in particular really fits in with our world very, very well. You know, he's sort of prêt-à-porté. He's, you know, that character's easy to bring over to Arrow.
Yeah.
And doesn't require much in the way of Arrowifying. It totally depends, you know, for us, we know what type of story we're telling, but this is again another area where DC is really great. You know, they recognize that we don't have a lot of go-to villains just out of the Green Arrow mythos. We've got to dig a little deeper into the DC universe itself if we're going to, you know, get to, you know, 23 episodes, much less 100 episodes.
Does this mean we won't be seeing the Dart or the Sling at all?
You know, it's like, well, Dodger, actually, we did in season one, and James played him, and, you know, I thought he was terrific. I love James Callis.
Yeah, he was great.
You know, so, and I would never say never that we wouldn't see him again. You know, and we have a way of doing onomatopoeia that we've been talking about since season one. So there's still some characters that we haven't touched from the comics that will probably find their way onto the show eventually. But, you know, again, it's all character and story first. We don't start off ever going, well, okay, this week we're doing onomatopoeia. What story do we want to tell with onomatopoeia? It's like, no, this week we're telling a story about Oliver and his, you know, friends and allies. What story do we want to tell with them? And if, you know, if onomatopoeia or any other, you know, comic book character helps us tell that story, that's what we'll end up putting them in the series.
Cool.
One of my favorite characters was, going back to season one, was Helena Bertinelli.
Oh, yeah. We love her. We love Helena. We love Jessica. You know, we love having her on the show, and we actually have a great story for her. We know what the next Huntress episode is going to be. We just don't know where it has, right now. We just don't know where it fits in our season. But we've been holding on to this idea ever since we had her on last season.
I think what I liked about it, if we get into the nitty gritty, was Ollie's, I guess, idealism that he could save her.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, his
just was, it was a good couple episodes.
Yeah, he's you know, it's funny, he's sort of been a bit of a tragic figure in that regard. He's got this idea in his head that she can be someone different than who she is.
Yeah.
Though I do think like their last beat in episode 17 of last year suggested that maybe Ollie has a point. Maybe Ollie is more right than we think. Because with her father's death, I think it turned a new page for Helena. And that's one of the reasons why we really want to get her back on the show, is that, you know, we were sort of telling this two-season-long story with Helena and her pursuit of vengeance. And now that that, you know, book has been closed, it's, you know, it gives us the opportunity to open up a new one.
Yeah.
And that's for us, that's the fun, exciting stuff, to be able to, you know, I think Jessica got tired of playing someone who was only hell-bent on killing her dad, and we got, you know, tired. We knew we had to bring a conclusion to that story, but we got tired of, you know, we get tired of writing it too. You know, we want to move on to some new territory with her. We're excited to do that. I just don't know when we will get to do that in season three, but, we know what we're going to do when we have the opportunity to do it.
Last week, Brian and I were talking, obviously we weren't part of the show, but he pitched a great idea for Birds of Prey.
Okay.
I mean,
a good idea from anywhere.
I mean, you pretty much already have two of the central characters, and I don't know if you could use Barbara Gordon or not. Or
we were just arguing over who could play, who should Oracle be.
Yeah, it would be feasible, you know, for Felicity to step into that Barbara Gordon role, but it's...
Oh, yeah, that's something we've discussed among ourselves for quite some time. And I think Barbara Gordon is, you know, is otherwise unavailable to us, but
right.
I do think that the combination of, you know, Canary, Huntress, Felicity, that's a fun combo.
Yeah.
That's something I would tune in to see. We've got some very cool ideas along those lines. It's always, for us, it's always, you know, again, where in the season does that feel right? You know, does it feel right to tell those, you know, to tell those stories? It's the type of thing where, you know, you wait and see, and then you pick your spots and you take your opportunities where you can find them.
Very cool.
Well, I think we had you on for an hour.
Sorry.
My wife is going like, when are we going to dinner?
Oh, sorry.
No, it's all good. It's all good. I told her it would take about an hour, so
we were just hoping for a half hour, so that's awesome, man.
Hey, not too bad. No, this is great, great fun, guys. I thank you so much for having me on the show.
Anything you want to give a
she can come on.
Anything you want to give a plug or shout out to, Mark?
Yeah, actually, thanks for the opportunity. You know, if you're interested in Overwatch, you can go to the Overwatch website, which is overwatchbook.com, where you'll see a trailer for the book, as well as download links, and purchase links for just about every way you can possibly get the book. And that's in print, digital, audio, you name it, it's available from your favorite vendor. And finally, if you are a fan of Arrow, please check out Arrow Season 2.5, because we're just having a blast doing that comic. It's a chance to dig into some of the deeper mysteries of the show that we just never have time to get into in the broadcast season. Even with 23 episodes, we have too much story and not enough episodes. So season 2.5 is a good place to get, you know, your deep dive into the world of Arrow.
Awesome. We got to check it out.
Definitely. Cool.
Yes. Thank you. Please do so.
Thank you so much, Mark. We really appreciate it.
Oh, no, my pleasure. Thank you, guys. I really appreciate it. I'm glad we were able to hook this up.
Yeah, I would love to have you on again at some point in time, maybe like towards the end of the season.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Just reach out to me via email, and you've got my email now, and we'll hook it up.
Sounds great.
Awesome. Thank you, Mark.
All right, I'm gonna go take my family to dinner.
Thanks, Mark.
Mark Guggenheim, everybody.
Bye, guys.
Take care. That was Mark Guggenheim, everybody, the writer and producer of Arrow. It was great. I thought it was a great interview. What do you think, Bri?
Oh, great. It's wonderful guy. Really nice. It's really fun, too.
I thought I had him a couple times.
I know.
I was surprised that he threw out the Captain Carrot one.
I know. Now we got something to look for.
I was thinking, I wonder what episode it's going to be in.
Yeah, definitely going to be checking that out every time.
So what's your week looking like, Brian? You got anything coming up?
I am working. You and I have already discussed, like we discussed last week and a couple weeks ago, some of the what Disney is doing with the X-Men. And the lack of merchandising for Days of Future Past and the fact that they aren't included in the cartoon or anything. So I'm starting to do some research to figure out if... there is something really going on here, and it just seems to be odd to me that so tied around the death of Wolverine, but I'm a conspiracy nut, what can I tell you?
So, do you have anything preliminary you can throw out at us, or are you holding those cards to your chest still?
I'm kind of, this is all speculation, I can't say any of this is true, but I'm just going to put out the facts, let people make their own decision.
Okay. I look forward to seeing that, Brian.
And that, that'll be available as soon as I get done with it.
as soon as time allows.
Yeah.
You can check me out on YFNJMan.com and TheFanboyFactor.com. I'll have my usual reviews and assorted nonsense out there.
Very cool. Always love viewing that stuff.
All right, Brian. So I guess I will talk to you next week.
Yes, sir.
All right, Brian. Have a good one.
You too.